How to get an apology from someone who's abused you when that abuser can't or won't give it.
So I thought to myself, well, maybe I need to write the apology that I've been waiting for. And maybe I need to create the words and say the words and really look at what is an apology. What is the anatomy of an apology? What are the tenets of an apology? What would I need to hear in order to get free?
That's Eve Ensler. Her new book, The Apology, is written in the voice of her father, who inflicted terrible emotional, sexual, and physical abuse on her when she was a child. We spend the hour with Ensler, first with The Apology, then with an excerpt from our 2006 interview with her about her book, Insecure at Last. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Like millions of women, Eve Ensler has been waiting much of her lifetime for an apology. Starting at the age of 5, she was sexually and then physically abused by her father. Ensler struggled her whole life from this betrayal, falling into addiction and self-destructive behavior as she wrestled with the demons her father had created. For years, she longed for an honest reckoning from a man who is long dead. After decades of work as an activist in the global movement to combat violence against women, Ensler decided she would wait no longer. She could imagine an apology by her, for her, to her. The book that emerged, The Apology, is written from her father's point of view, in the words she longed to hear. It transforms the abuse she suffered with unflinching truthfulness and compassion into a healing journey of liberation. Eve Ensler is a Tony Award-winning playwright, performer, and activist. Her play, The Vagina Monologues, has been translated into 48 languages and performed thousands of times throughout the world. Ensler's experience performing The Vagina Monologues inspired her to create V-Day, a global activist movement to stop violence against women and girls. She's the author of numerous other plays and books, including the memoir In the Body of the World and the book Insecure at Last. Eve Ensler, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's actually been, I think, at least 10 years.
Oh, my God. Amazing. Well, hi.
And this book, The Apology, is just an absolutely searing book. It's in some ways a memoir, not in your voice. It's called The Apology, but it's an apology that you write to yourself in the voice of your father. Now, he has been dead for 31 years. He subjected you to terrible emotional and sexual incest, as well as physical abuse, when at the age of 11 you began to defy him. What was the process by which you became able, finally, to write this book?
Well, that's a good question. I think it was a combination of forces. I think, for one thing, all my childhood I waited for an apology. I think one of the reasons I was always writing apology letters was secretly hoping they would kind of stimulate his desire to write an apology to me. And I think, so there's that piece, right? And then, having worked in the movement to end violence against women for so many years, and with this new amazing iteration of Me Too, I've been thinking, okay, we've told our stories, we've broken the silence, we've built the shelters, we've opened hotlines. But in all this time, I have never heard a man make a public, thorough, authentic apology. And it started to really hit me. Okay, I started to ask around, has anybody heard a public, thorough, authentic apology from a man? And nobody had. And the few men who have written after they've been accused or after their careers have collapsed have written about mainly how terrible it's been for them, you know, with kind of a underlying self-pity about the hard luck they've faced. So I started to think there's something here. there's something in this no apology that's core to what we have to look at if we're going to go to the next level of really ending violence against women and girls, all women and girls. And so I thought to myself, well, maybe I need to write the apology that I've been waiting for. And maybe I need to create the words and say the words and really look at what is an apology. What is the anatomy of an apology? What are the tenets of an apology? What would I need to hear in order to get free?
So tell us what are some of the tenets of an apology, and you maybe give us an example of how you follow that in this book.
There's a bunch of things. I think for one thing, it's a humbling. It's the perpetrator or the abuser making himself or herself vulnerable. It's an equalizer. There can't be anybody on top and anyone on the bottom. It's a connection. The second piece of it is, I think it's a thorough, detailed accounting of what you've done and what your motivation was behind what you've done. The liberation is in the details. It can't be, I'm sorry if I hurt you, or I'm sorry if I did this thing to you, or any of that. It's got to be very specific and very exact. And then I think it's really allowing yourself to feel what your victim felt when you did what you did to her. What were the long-term impacts of that on her, on her family, on her community? And then it's going deep inside yourself to look at what brought you to do those things. What in your childhood? What in the acculturation into patriarchy and toxic masculinity? What in your life led you to become or go from being a kind of tender, wondrous child, boy, to somebody who was capable of raping, of harassing, of beating, of demeaning, of abusing a woman or another human being? And then I think the last piece of that is becoming accountable and apologizing and evidencing that you're not capable of doing something like that ever again.
You know, there were so many points in this book where I was just enraged at your father, that I felt he was just an incredible monster, and which I think he was. And in the book, you do excavate the backstory, what led to him being who he was. How did you walk that line between compassion and condemnation?
Well, I think that was the hardest part of the book, because I think, you know, it took me many years to get ready to write this book. You know, I didn't, and I want to say it's an offering. It's not a prescription. It's not a have to. If this idea works for survivors, do it. If it doesn't, that's fine. But I was at a point in my life where I was really beginning to feel a freedom coming into my life. And I felt there were parts of me that were still hooked into this kind of ongoing narrative or relationship with me being a perpetual victim to my father's abuser or perpetrator. And I wanted to get free of that. I wanted to be living in another narrative, another paradigm. And I think part of that meant I had to let myself see who my father was and what made my father what he was. I think the other piece of that is that we're often as survivors haunted by the why. Why did my boyfriend drug me and rape me on a date? Why did my father want to kill his daughter? Why? And I think going back and looking at what made my father who he was really began to give me missing pieces to the story of that why. And that really helped free me, because it got it out of this amorphous, you know, this general feeling of you're just a bad person and bad things happen, and this abstracted thing, into a very specific timeline of my father's evolution or de-evolution into a sadist and an abuser. And I have to say that feeling for my father in the course of this book, feeling the pain he had undergone as a child, was really hard, but it really turned my father. You know, I think as survivors, we hold our perpetrators inside us, right? If someone rapes you or beats you or demeans you, they enter you and they're embedded in you. And I think what I learned doing this book is that we can turn how they live in us in another direction. My father went from this monolithic monster to an apologist, from this terrifying entity to a broken, wounded child. And in that sense, he lost agency over me, and power, you know?
Agency and power. Yes. And yet, you write this book in his voice. I mean, I can barely imagine how difficult that was. And there's even a place in which he asks, is it you who's writing it, you, Eve? Of course, you are writing it. Or is it him who's writing it? And that's actually a real question.
It's a real question to me, to be honest with you. I mean, I think once I opened the portal to his voice and to him to come through, there were moments when I really don't know who was writing this book. You know, it's not my vocabulary. It's certainly not that kind of authorial voice, isn't my voice. You know, I think people live so deeply inside us, our parents, people we're very familiar with, people we have been very impacted by. And I went into kind of a 4-month trance state. This is the only way I can describe it, where I worked on this morning, noon, and night, and he would show up and talk. And who is what? I don't know. It was a conjuring.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with playwright, author, and activist Eve Ensler about her latest book, The Apology. And now give us a sense of the abuse when it started. You started at the age of 5, but I think it in many ways started before that because there was a kind of emotional incest from the very beginning. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you are. I guess I didn't experience it that or understand it as such till much later. I think my father, I think he adored me, you know, and he was obsessed with me. And it's interesting because I think one of the things that damaged my father the most as a boy was that he was adored. He was the golden boy. He was the divine right of kings. And yet that adoration wasn't love. It was a kind of projected idealization of his parents onto him, which I don't know if it had much to do with who he was at all. And so all these pieces of himself that didn't fit into that ideal image, he had to bury, right? And eventually they metastasized and it surfaced at a later point in what he called the shadow man. And I think to some degree, my father did very similar things to me. He had this idealization of me, this worship of me that, of course, it feels very heady. Of course, you feel fantastic that someone thinks you're so special. And yet at the same time, you feel kind of weird, you know, like you haven't earned it. Or what is it? Or what does it have to do with me? And then I think that then led him to cross a line where he began to sexually invade and abuse me. And I think part of it is that my father, when he was a boy, was never allowed his own tenderness. He was never allowed to be tender, to express tenderness to himself, to express tenderness in the world. And so all that was pushed underground. And I think when I was born, I kind of catalyzed this overwhelming feeling of tenderness in him that he didn't know what to do with. He had never learned how to sit with it or just feel it or experience it without doing something about it, exploiting it or having it or crushing it or raping it or, you know, conquering it or making it go away. And I think this is something we do to boys. We don't allow them to have their tenderness. We shut that down. We cut that off. We tell them to man up and not be weak and not be vulnerable and not cry. And we can go down the list. So I think that sexual invasion and that sexual abuse was his attempt to cope or to deal with what he was feeling in a very kind of perverse way.
I mean, it's pretty extreme, too. But you mentioned before boys. I mean, you do make this larger point. You know, I think at one point he references a Pandora's box, which is really a Pandora's box of toxic masculinity, and he talks about bargaining, manipulating, holding his own interests above all else. I think that last one was a real clue to, you know, whether he was being, you know, so-called sweet to you or being abusive or being sexual with you. All of that was just simply all about him.
All about him. All about him. And I think this incapacity to feel empathy, to break out of that kind of toxic masculinity, which forms as this kind of diabolical narcissism, right? Where your concerns and your needs and your way is the only thing that matters. And the belief that you're entitled to that and privileged to that. And certainly the world has let men believe that for a long time. And so I think he made excuses to himself to justify what he must have known was wrong and crossing a very diabolical boundary, right? But he took care of his needs. And in doing that, he tore the basic foundation of my humanity in some way, you know?
He did. And he also really turned on you. I mean, when you became, you know, when you began to fight back, he was brutal.
Well, I think at the point where I really turned away from him and the point where I made it clear that this couldn't go on anymore, and basically by pretending I was dead, talk about metaphors, right? You know, where do we go in order to stop our perpetrators? I mean, the most self-damaging places, right? At that point, there were two things going on. One, his arrogance and his just disbelief that I would ever not let him have what he wanted. But also there was part of him, I was very damaged by then. You know, I was having nightmares all the time. I had stopped washing my hair. I cut off all my hair. I was a very unhappy child. You know, I was having infections all the time. And I was evidence of what he had done, right? So there was part of him that wanted to destroy that. He didn't want to be looking at the outcome of his abuse.
And your family were so complicit. I mean, not just your mother, which is bad enough, but your siblings as well. Talk about the family dynamics and how did this happen in this way? And was he abusive to anyone else?
Well, I don't really talk about my brother and sister because I respect their privacy, you know. But I will say, as a family unit, it so mirrors in some ways governments and institutions, if we just look around. I mean, I think, you know, once there's one person who has all the power and they are using violence and they are using terror as a dominant weapon, everybody, based on their personality, responds to that differently, right? Some people are defiant. Some people withdraw. Some people become accomplices. And all of them, all of those are survival responses to some degree. So I feel, certainly at the time I didn't feel this. Now I have much more understanding and compassion for all the choices people made in my family in relationship to someone who was constantly terrorizing us, you know. But I think what my father was genius at and what our current, you know, predator in chief is genius at is dividing and conquering, is always making someone feel like they were worse than the other person and highlighting one person to the detriment of another person. So people were always shifting alliances and wanting to turn someone in because it benefited them. And I think my mother, who in some ways was really a fourth child, you know, she was a woman who had come from a very impoverished background in the Midwest. My father was really her way out of that story. By the time I was born, you know, I was the second child. And by the time the abuse was in high gear, there were three children. And my mother had no economic resources. She had no ability to leave. She had no job. She had no wherewithal to support us. And at a certain point in our relationship, when I finally confronted her, she basically told me that she sacrificed me, that she couldn't see a future. And she certainly knew my father was terrorizing me physically on a regular basis. And she was willing to allow that to keep the security of the rest of the family.
And what was her affect as she told you this? I mean, did she make an apology?
She did. She did. And I think before she died, we went through a long and deep ongoing process of working on this together. And I think by the time she left this world, we were in a very beautiful place with each other. But, you know, my mother was of a very different generation. She didn't see herself as someone who had agency over her own life. She was taught to believe that men were in charge and men ruled. And my father was a very scary person and very, very controlling. And for her to leave that would have meant risking a kind of insecurity she wasn't willing to face.
And how did you know about what had formed him in this way? In other words, what were the sources of the compassionate part of the story that you uncovered?
Well, I knew some things about his childhood. I had heard stories, you know, hints about his brother. But a lot of it I conjured. A lot of it it came through me based on who my father was, pieces of his story that I had heard. I mean, I knew he was the youngest child, much later than the others. I had moments in my life with my father, like the story of the cat, and other moments where I got glimpses of this part of my father that he had never exposed and clearly covered. Do you know what I mean? So it was all extrapolating and conjuring and imagining.
The story of the cat?
The story of the cat happened. That was a real story. And that story, you know, was a very painful story, but also a very amazing moment where, you know, I had this cat that I adored and somehow became this way of my father and I communicating tenderness between us because he came to love this cat. And then one day the cat got run over and I came home and my father was holding the cat and I looked at him and he was crying. And I just saw this part of him that he had never shown me, this tenderness, this vulnerability that I'll never forget. It was just like a window into who he might have been had he not been wrecked by the ravages of patriarchy.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with Eve Ensler about her latest book, The Apology. And tell us what happened at your graduation, because that was a real inflection point.
It was. I had been elected by my classmates to give the keynote speech. And I gave this very, you know, when I was like 22 years old, there were thousands some odd people. I gave the speech about feminism and racial justice. And then I was terrified and I did it and I did it fairly well, I think. And then I walked outside and I lit a cigarette and my father was suddenly there and he lit my cigarette and he never mentioned the speech to me. He never said one word about it. And all I wanted was my father to say, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, what anybody wants. I wanted him to be proud of me. And he stood there, we stood in silence. And then he reached into his pocket. He handed me a check for $1,000. He shook my hand and he said, have a good life. And it was like someone had taken a fist and punched it in the center of my gut. And it took me years and years to recover from that.
Yeah, I mean, you were physically free of him, but not of who he was inside you. You know, what therapists call the introject.
Yeah.
You got involved with drugs and did a lot of other really risky, even suicidal behavior. And yet, you also became a beacon for women, a world-renowned activist working with women who are the victims of horrific rapes during war, an acclaimed writer and playwright. How did you get from there to here?
Well, I think there are many pieces of that story. For one thing, I always had a really huge strain of defiance in me. I think that my survival mechanism was, you will not tell me what to do. I despised authority. And I had some part of me that was just not going to be determined by their idea of me or what they were doing to me. And I don't know, who knows what makes us who we are. The second piece of it was that imagination absolutely saved my life. I had imaginary characters, you know, and people in my childhood who were always about to come and save me. And I think I started writing at a very young age, at 10, to kind of create an alternative world, alternative persona that could get me out of the mess I was in. But I have to say, it was also really discovering that if you could reach out and help someone who was a little worse off than you, you could get out of your own pain. And I think that led me to activism and that led me to working for social justice, for racial justice, for, you know, the liberation of women and ending wars and fighting nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons. You know, all of that kept me alive. And I think I learned early on, you heal yourself by giving what you want the most, not waiting for people to give it to you, because it certainly wasn't coming in my family. And then, of course, there were people along the way, those amazing people who intervene at the right moment in your life, who love you, who see you, and who are the people who carry you through the disasters, even, you know, when you can't see yourself. The 12-step programs helped me immensely, and communities of people who are working on themselves to not drink, to survive and figure out how to release themselves from the shackles and the pain that incest had wrought, you know, good therapist and dancing. Dancing's always been a salvation.
You say that they carried you. You also carry in this book the image of yourself as a child that is just beautiful. I mean, really a point of light, a young child, a golden child. Did you keep that golden child alive all those years in some place of you, or did you more discover her in the process of writing this book?
I think my struggle has been really for years and years and years getting out of the sense that I was bad, that I was shamed, that I was guilty, that I was stupid. I mean, that was my curse, you know, and the curse that my father laid on me. And I think that's been the hardest struggle of my life. But I think that that child that was there before my father got a hold of her, you know, I think there's a part of us that we protect somehow. We conceal it. We put it in a little place where people can't get to it. And I think that child manifested itself in my writing, in my activism, in the love I had. I adopted a son when I was 23 and he was 15. And I think that that person who wanted to love, that adored people, found outlets throughout my life, you know. But I must say, writing this book, really going in and writing that apology to myself, has really freed the part of me that that is good, that I really believe is good, that I believe wants the best for people, that I believe, you know, is struggling for a world where we aren't violated, where we aren't invaded, where we embrace everybody coming over our borders who wants a better life, where we live in a world where white supremacy is over, where I can go down the list. And I feel so grateful to be on the other side of this book. I feel like I'm in a new world. I feel like I've stepped out of some of that paradigm or that narrative of being a victim. And I don't know who I am yet, but I'm really thinking of even changing my name.
But Eve is such a wonderful name.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I feel like it's part of an old story, and it's part of a story of who is Eve? She was the woman who brought sin and downfall to the world, right?
And born of the rib of Adam.
Born of the rib of Adam. And I don't know. I think I don't know. I'm in the process of dreaming of it. So something's emerging.
And this was a very difficult book for me to read because, I mean, my history was nowhere near as bad as yours. I can say that. But I was molested by my stepfather, and I never got an apology from him. But he only did it once because I did tell my mother, and my mother defended me.
Wow. Good for her.
It was good for her. And so he never touched me again, but he also, until I was well into my 30s, he never had a kind word to say to me. So throughout my childhood, there was that cruelty, that sense that I was bad as well. And, you know, I wrote a letter to him that I never sent, and it helped. And then at one point I did tell him the impact of how he treated me on my life, and he listened, but he didn't say anything, and there was no apology. I thought about doing what you did, and I still find it too painful. So if you might just give a note of advice to those of us who might want to try to do something, how do you protect yourself while you're doing it?
Well, you know, this is something I learned. And I think if you're going to do, I'll tell you something really interesting. You know, we, V-Day supports a beautiful place in the Congo called the City of Joy, which I founded with Christine Schuller, Describer, and Dr. Denis Mukwege, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And it's an amazing sanctuary and revolutionary center for women in Congo who are recovering from insane sexual abuse and trauma. And women come for 6 months, 90 women at a time, and they go through a therapeutic, educational, political process. And they started doing this exercise with them, where they wrote letters to themselves from their perpetrators apologizing, and they're having extraordinary results. I would say, first of all, you should do it with somebody. Like, you should have a therapist or a counselor or a clergy or a friend who's supporting you through it. But this is something I learned. There's a wound in just about all of us, a central wound. And what we are made to feel and believe is if we go into the wound, we will die. Like, it will kill us. And I actually learned from writing this book that there's a doorway in the center of the wound. And if you are willing to go through the wound, there is freedom on the other side. There is real freedom. Most of us park our buggies outside the wound. And so we're just kind of in this, we just get the radiation that's coming down from the wound, right? But if we're willing to go through it, and that's not to say that journey through it isn't painful. It is. There were moments writing this book where I was curled up on the floor weeping. But I could sense in the distance that there was a liberation, that there was a release that was going to be really powerful. And I think it's just trusting that if you go through the wound, you will begin to taste freedom you have never known. But I think you can't do it alone. I think you have to do it carefully. I think you have to be comforted while you're doing it. And you have to comfort yourself while you're doing it.
Wow. Well, you are a woman of extraordinary courage and so much of a help to so many other women in the world. And this book is just such an important contribution, The Apology.
Thank you
so much for talking with us here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for your careful reading and your wonderful questions. Really appreciate it.
Eve Ensler. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Apology. Next up, we hear an edited version of my 2006 interview with Ensler about her book, Insecure at Last. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Back in 2006, I spoke with Eve Ensler about her book, Insecure at Last, Losing It in Our Security-Obsessed World. In the book, she asks whether our fixation on security is making us more fearful than ever. And what does security mean anyway? In the interview, we explored security, insecurity, and breaking down the walls that make us all less secure. Now, your title of your last book, Insecure at Last, why that title? Why did you call it that?
Well, the book is really looking at this whole notion of, quote, security. And it really struck me when I was traveling around America doing my show, The Good Body, that the country's become absolutely obsessed with security and be security check, security clearance. And I started thinking, why, when everyone's focused on security, have I never felt more insecure? Like, what's going on? And that kind of began this examination and exploration, looking at my last 10 years of my life as filtered through this lens of security. And I think what the book is looking at or thinking about is the fact that all this focus on security, which is essentially impossible and elusive, we all get old, we all die, we all change, we fall in and out of love. There's nothing that's secure. The idea that America has become a place where we are suddenly a people obsessed with security above all else when it's essentially impossible, seems slightly mad, but also I think this obsession with security above all else has made us oddly more insecure. And by that I mean if we were focused on compassion or kindness or connection or justice or feeding people, or we would actually probably move the little security we can expect forward. But because we're now focused on this uber security, it's undermining everything.
Yeah, so that's one side kind of the equation. You talk about how security, our obsession with security, leads to insecurity, but there's also another kind of piece to it, and how insecurity may not be all that bad a thing.
Exactly. I think, you know, what I say is that I'm 53 and I've never felt more insecure and I've never been happier. And I think part of it is that I think for a lot of us, we go through life believing that eventually we're going to get secure. And so we're after it, and we're pursuing it, and we're hungry for it. And then I think when you get older, you suddenly realize that, no, we're not going to be secure. And this quest for it is really at the root of our unhappiness. And when you suddenly realize that, no, the job here is to feel really okay with being insecure and to kind of just go with whatever that big, wondrous, messy, delicious, passionate thing is called insecurity. And I guess for me this last year or last few years has been coming into a kind of comfortability and a kind of joy in the insecurity.
Well, you grew up in a middle-class home where you had economic security, but you say that that security didn't come for free.
No, and, you know, I always say I was one of those people who grew up in a house where we actually had a white picket fence in front of it, and, you know, I had all the kind of trappings or all the images of what security is. We had money, I had braces, I went to a good school. But inside my home, my father was a very violent person who was beating me and molesting me and on a regular basis. And I was essentially traumatized and always in a state of fear. And so I never bought this idea called security. There was a huge split in me being told how happy and secure I was when my life was being threatened on an almost daily basis. And I think I was highly suspect of security from a very young age. And so when I went into the world, I was very much drawn to that which I was most afraid of because I had this kind of deep need to master or conquer it. And through my travels, particularly in the last 10 years to about 40 countries, to war zones and post-disaster sites and refugee camps and prisons and places where, you know, you would think they'd be really scary, what has basically happened is any notion I have of security has deconstructed, but what's come in its place is this profound connection with human beings, and that is much more valuable and fulfilling than security.
You certainly weave the political and the personal in together, and I just want to say I was very moved by your book, and I had to think when you talk about the happiness that comes from realizing one's insecurity, I'm reminded of a time, about 15 years ago, I went through a very serious depression, which was the first and only time I've done that. And it was all about this. It was that I didn't have security, I didn't have the husband, I didn't have the house, I didn't have the career I thought I should have by that time. I was in my 40s. And one day found myself on a hillside in Big Sur, California, with my son, my young son then, and all of a sudden I was unutterably happy, and I realized that I no longer had any hope, and that's what made me happy. I didn't have a hope that I would have this, that, or the other thing. I was just simply happy to be.
Exactly. Exactly. You're not in any story anymore. You're just in the moment. There's something so liberating about that and so joyous.
Yes. So I want to get back to what you were just talking about or started to talk about, and that is your experiences with people who are suffering a kind of insecurity that I can't even imagine. For example, you were invited to a camp in Zagreb, Croatia, where the women there had been raped, had been in rape camps, in fact.
Right.
Why were you invited there?
Well, that particular first journey, I was not invited to. I invited myself. I was very much drawn to the stories of what was happening to women in the former Yugoslavia during the war, and I felt really compelled to go and listen and see if there was anything I could possibly do to be of help, because I couldn't believe there were rape camps in the middle of in Europe in 1994. And I actually wrote letters and sent resumes and sent descriptions so that they would accept me into their world and let me come and listen. And it took months, and when they finally accepted, I felt like I had won the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, and I went and I slept on their couch, and I thought I was going for weeks, and I went for months. And that was really the beginning, you know, of me coming to, you know, understand that our work is not to fix people or have answers or sum things up, but it's just to be with people, to listen to people, to cry with people, to sit with people. And that was a radical transformation in my life. Again, to be insecure with people. you know.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about you were first talking to them across a kind of journalistic divide. Mm-hmm. I want you to talk about that. First, I'd like our listeners to get a taste of how you write about this experience. And if you could read on page 11, maybe just give us the immediate context of what's going on, and then start reading the two paragraphs that start with "tears broke out of my eyes."
Well, this was having been, I had gone and I was sitting in camps and refugee centers, and I was interviewing lots and lots of women who had survived terrible atrocities, particularly rapes, and I had been doing it for hours and hours and hours and days. And finally I had this opportunity to be alone in this woman's apartment, and it was the first time I had been able to sit in it and hear it and feel it, and I fell apart. And there was nothing to do but to kind of go into the experience itself, you know? And this I wrote when I was in that moment. Tears broke out of my eyes like glass cutting flesh, breaking me, breaking through my craving for definition, authority, fame, somebodyhood, breaking all that into little tiny pieces that became nothing I could identify, nothing that resembled me or the matter of me. Me was lost. There was just melting, bandages unwrapping, me becoming invisible. It wasn't the cruelty that broke my heart. Cruelty is boring, generic. What hurt in my chest was witnessing the unsuspecting nature of the women, how unprepared they were, how shocked and disbelieving. What hurt was feeling love for these lost women who sat around a wobbly refugee table, the woman who clung to her one plastic bag or made sweet pastry in what was now her kitchen, bedroom, living room, bathroom, all in one. Made pastry for me, a stranger. The woman who kept smiling with missing teeth, who gave strength to the woman next to her, who smoked cigarettes and smoothed her skirt or apologized for her messy hair. What hurt was that their life was over. What hurt was that they kept going.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Eve Ensler, author of The Vagina Monologues, about her latest book, Insecure at Last, Losing It in Our Security-Obsessed World. Yeah, there's this sense of the terrible vulnerability, but that's the thing that actually brings you together with the women.
Yeah, yeah. And it's truly what I've seen over and over. Do you know what I mean? It's what opens our hearts and what dissolves us that brings us together. And we think we protect against it, but it's really... it's funny, when you are able to melt and to dissolve into that which you're defending yourself against, it's always when you get free, you know?
Talk about that for you. I mean, you were not at first coming from that place of melting. And you yourself, as you said before, you've been through some of these terrible experiences, maybe not quite to the degree, but it sounds pretty horrific the way your childhood was. How did you manage negotiating this border between protecting yourself and then hearing these experiences of other people?
Well, you know, I think when I started going, when I first went to places, I was so, I thought I was going to have it all together. You know, I was going to be professional, and I was going to go in, and I was going to ask questions and be objective, and all those words that I don't even know who invented those words, you know, as if there's such a thing as objectivity, as if there's such a way that we ever really get out of ourselves. But really what I have, I ironically discovered time and time again, is the way I have survived everything in my life is by going through it, not by avoiding it, not by repressing it, not by denying it, not by shutting it off, but by going through it. And I think so much of violence is based on unexpressed grief. So much of retaliation and revenge is based on unexpressed sadness and sorrow. You know, it said, chapter in the book, which is when I learned that bullets were hardened tears, you know, and I think we think we're going to die if we feel what we're feeling, but in fact, what kills us is not feeling what we're feeling. It's like when feelings get metastasized and they start spreading these little cancerous things all over our beings, you know, these hardened pockets that are not expressed.
Well, yeah, and talk about that experience with the tears becoming bullets. I mean, there are actually several places in the book where you struggled with your own prejudices, and this was one of them. I mean, you were in Kosovo with a man named Agim. Tell us what happened and why he made you so uncomfortable.
Well, you know, we had been in Kosovo for some a few days, and we had been trying to bring emergency relief to people who needed it, and we met this beautiful woman and her old mother in their backyard, and they were essentially living on the ground, and they had nothing. And the grandmother was just saying, and the first time we met them, I wouldn't care if my two sons would come home. I would live without nothing, and I would be perfectly okay, because her sons had disappeared. They had been gone for about a year, and she had never heard from them, and she was sure they were dead. And I felt so bad, we all did, for this woman lying on the ground, that we came back the next day, and we bought mattresses and blankets, and they were living in this kind of burnt-out backyard of their house, which was completely destroyed and graffiti-ridden. And anyway, when we arrived with their blankets and mattresses, we heard this kind of commotion going on, and what had happened was that her son, had come literally 5 minutes before we had gotten back for the first time in a year. And they were all just hugging and kissing and, you know, just screaming in the yard. And then for some reason, when he saw me, he just threw his arms around me and he started to wail. But I'm talking like sob and sob and sob. And it was my reaction to it really baffled me. Because on one part of me, I was like, oh my God, there's a man wailing in my arms. I don't think I've ever seen this. And the other part of me was, there's a man wailing in my arms. I wish he would stop. I really don't like it when men are like this. This is making me really uncomfortable. He's not supposed to be doing this. And I was shocked that I had both those voices in me. You know, I'm a feminist. I have always stated I want men to be tender and to feel. And I saw how, you know, how deeply ingrained that training is, what we expect of men and what we want of men. And we want someone to know the way. We want someone to hold, you know what I mean, to hold the, I don't know, to hold the thing that is perfect and secure, you know. And it was a very, very profound moment for me, because as he continued to cry in my arms, he did for quite some time, and eventually the whole community gathered to watch it because it was an event, it was this ritual, this occurrence, I realized that that's really what I deeply longed for, was for a man to fall apart in my arms and for me to let go of this idea that anybody knows what's going on or anybody has the way. You know, right. Because we're all essentially lost here, aren't we? We don't know what we're doing here. I mean, people have suppositions and, you know, suggestions, but for the most part, we're all lost together in this, and there's a beauty in that.
Absolutely. Well, did he tell you what that was about?
Well, I think it was just the relief of seeing his mother, the sorrow at having been gone, that this just the horror that his house had been ruined, do you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was all of the above, you know.
And when was this exactly?
It was the day after the war ended in Kosovo.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this was an Albanian family, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, the other case was in a prison in New York, in Bedford Hills.
Mm-hmm.
That is a case of struggling with your prejudices in a way and then making a connection. And that was with a woman who had molested children. Talk a little bit about that and why it was so hard for you initially to accept her. What would she like? Describe her for us.
Well, you know, when I think everybody has, again, all these suppositions, right, that we have about everything, you know? And when I first went to Bedford Hills, I had an idea of what women who did violent crimes were. You know, they were murderers, they were thieves, they were, I think we all make up stories like who they are. We fix them. They are their crime. They are their mistake. We harden them in our minds. And it's much easier. Like if you think bad person goes to prison, dismiss, erase, disappear, we never have to think about them again. They're not us, right? We're not capable of bad things. None of us are capable. Only them. It's so much easier to go there. And what happened when I went to prison is, of course, all of that was exploded and deconstructed immediately. Because I started to realize how complicated everyone was, and how when I would sit in the midst of my writing group, I would see brilliant women, and I would see loving women, and I would see caring mothers, and profoundly good wives, and incredible friends, and, you know, people who were full of angst over what they had done, and, you know, the list goes on. And I think that, again, blew away all these assumptions I had and ideas of security, because when things are one thing, it's easier to grab hold. And I met this woman. There had been this woman in the group who I didn't like at all. And I had been interviewing these women every week, and they were talking about their childhoods from like 1 to 9, we would do the first week, and then 9 to 18 the next week, and 8. And there was something in this woman who just gave me the creeps. And I knew she was there for child molestation, and because of my own story, I didn't like her, I didn't want her near me, I had incredible judgments about her, I was closed off to her, I thought she was ugly. And then the second week she ended up sitting next to me. And I was like, oh my God, she's sitting next to me. Well, when we got to her story, she started to tell her story, and I couldn't believe it. And basically what it was that she had been molested from the time she was a little girl, and she had been sold out by her parents as a sexual toy and an object, essentially a dildo that was just used by all these men and tied to beds, and terrible things were done to her. And when she got older, her mother died and her stepfather married her, and then he insisted they bring other children into the nest. And she became his gigolo in a way, and she would go out and get children, and they would do it together. And when she was doing this, apparently somebody died. And when she came to prison, she had no idea why she was there in terms of the sexual part, because no one had ever created a moral standard in which she could understand that that was bad. That was all she had known in her life. So I just sat there and I cried through the whole story, obviously. And I cried because she was sitting in a group of all women in prison who had all been molested, who had all been through terrible times, and they all hated her. And yet she was still telling her story and owning her culpability and saying that it took her 5 years in prison to know why she was there. And then she started to cut herself and try to kill herself because she finally got it.
What was the reaction of the others who, you know, as you say, had hated her all along, had kind of been in the same place you had, when she told her story? Did anything change for her?
I think it changed for everybody. I mean, I think everybody in the group, just to hear the specificities of it, right, was utterly blown away, you know. And I think that she was honest and she was willing to tell the truth also was a whole other piece. And I think what I certainly understood is you cannot judge anyone, really, until you know where they come from. You can't make up a story. Do you know what I mean? Until you know what someone's been through and what's led them to do and become who they've become, it's very hard to make judgments about people.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're listening back to an edited version of my 2006 interview with Eve Ensler about her book, Insecure at Last.
I think what we like to do, because it makes it easier to live and pretend we're secure, is we like to divide people up into things. Like to say, there's a criminal. There's a bad person. We're good people. What I keep learning over and over is that every single one of us is capable of doing heinous acts, given circumstances. And that's not to say everybody who has terrible conditions and heinous experiences does terrible acts. But it is to say we have to look at the conditions and the situations that compel people to do terrible things. And we have to look in ourselves to see that we're all capable of it and that we're all full of many ambiguities and complexities and contradictions. And I think part of what we have to start really examining and looking at as a culture is, why are we so terrified of ambiguity? Why are we so terrified to see all the complexities that exist in the world? Why have we become a culture that's about sound bites and reductive thinking rather than really opening ourselves to the whole beginning, middle, and end of the story? We're just in one little piece of the story. We don't want to see the whole story, you know?
It's almost as if people think they won't be secure if they allow ambiguity.
Exactly. And of course, what we know is that the ability to tolerate ambiguity and to understand it and to work is what makes you secure. You know, just by suppressing it or denying it, it gives you an illusion of security. I mean, Iraq is the perfect example of that. No one wanted to look at the complicated story at the beginning. What would our actions in Iraq do? how would bombing and occupying and destroying a country work to make people safer? There was no investigation whatsoever of that question. It was just make people afraid, tell them we're going to drop bombs and kill somebody, and they'll feel better.
There's another thing, finally, I'd like to ask you about. You say that Americans hate themselves, that we hate ourselves, we hate who we are, that we're so lonely. You know, I was surprised by that because I often think that we're a heartless culture. You know, that it's our failure to connect or to care about others. But you say we just want kindness.
You see, I don't think we're heartless. I think Americans are actually really beautiful people. I think we have been sold this ongoing idea that we're not skinny enough, rich enough, famous enough, light enough, tight enough, white enough. We can go down the list. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, it's a consumer culture. It's a capitalist culture. How else do you get people to keep buying things if you don't convince them something's wrong with them and they need to fix it? So we're living in a world that has convinced people over and over and over that something is essentially wrong with them. Celebrity culture is based on there are people who have it and got it right, and the rest of us who are messed up and will never get it right. And so I've seen just really in the last years that I've been traveling around the country, and it's been really extensive, people just feel either fat or ugly or stupid or poor, or, you know, that they just haven't figured out how to make the dream work, and they have failed. And that has led them to this kind of apathy, you know, where they're just unable to act or function or even believe they're worth saving, worth fighting for, or that anybody would care what they had to say if they were to stand up.
You know? If we're heartless, it's more because we think nobody cares about us.
Totally.
Well, Eve Ensler, thanks so much for talking with us here at Writer's Voice.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
And the book is Insecure at Last, Losing It in Our Security-Obsessed World. And that interview with Eve Ensler aired on Writer's Voice in early January of 2007. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Sarah Collins about her acclaimed debut novel, The Confessions of Franny Langton. We also speak with Christina Proenza Coles about her remarkable history, American Founders, How People of African Descent Established Freedom in the New World. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.